You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We've been lucky so far, despite the recent heat waves up and down California, no major wildfires. But we are all smart enough to know that our luck here in California typically tends to run out when it comes to wildfires. We have seen it and we have experienced it all too often. Sadly, Canada is suffering this year. Smoke from hundreds of fires burning in Canada continues to pour into the U.S., even as far south as Alabama. It's been going on for more than a month, and it's not the only extreme wildfire behavior blanketing the region. Greece and other parts of Europe are experiencing wildfires as well. Our next guest recently published opinion pieces for CNN and the New York Times about what other countries around the world could learn from the United States, including California's mistakes, when it comes to having a healthy relationship with fire. Claire Frank spent 30 years as a firefighter and became Cal Fire's Chief of Fire Protection. She was the first and only woman to reach that rank. Claire is now a writer and an author of a book called Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. Claire, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Vicky. Happy to be here.
I got a little taste of your memoir because I judged a literary death match, which you actually won. So great work.
Thank you. It was great. That was great fun with you.
It was a lot of fun. Let's start from the very beginning. What got you into firefighting?
My brother, he knew from the time he locked himself in the house when he was 2 years old and the fire engine came. And my mom witnessed him jumping up and down on the couch as soon as the engine came. And from that point on, he just started drawing himself on the tailboard of fire engines he drew. So he knew, and I was his tag-along sister, so I followed him in.
Wow, and then it was pretty much the rest was history after that.
Yeah, I feel it
felt... Hook, line, and sinker.
It did. I call it love at first flame.
You know, given that, you know, you have such a long perspective and trajectory with wildfires, specifically in California as a firefighter, when did you begin realizing through your experience as a firefighter that wildfire management was falling short here?
Not till late in my career. I mean, I was very suppression centric when I was on an engine, like fire burned and I had a job and that was to put it out. But I didn't really recognize the bigger landscape of things until I entered into the chief ranks and started looking at fire policy and living with fire and land management. But then I, you know, with look backs to my suppression experience, I could go, oh, there's an example of something we did wrong or something we did right.
And you've been on both ends of this, a firefighter on the front lines and also a homeowner or someone that has been evacuated as well because of a wildfire. You were impacted by the Caldor fire.
I was, and that was after I retired, and it was the first time I'd been on that side of things, like as a civilian with no, you know, no crews to call, no engine to jump on, and so that was a very different experience for me.
When did you begin thinking about putting these experiences as a firefighter, putting pen to paper, authoring a book, and also writing opinion pieces? You know, two have just published in the last month or two.
Yeah, I did not want to write about fire. I knew I was going to write after I retired. I always had that in my blood. My mother was a children's book author, and my uncle was a relatively famous author. And so I knew I was going to do this thing, but I wanted to quit fire cold turkey, right? I did all I can do with fire. But that's when the fires started going from these harbinger fires that I experienced during my career into these, you know, these are no longer harbingers. These are the real deal. These are mega fires. And the smoke poured into the valley that I moved to in Nevada. I'm like, fire is following me. This is freaky. But it was, you know, I was writing, and again, my brother had a role in this. He said, well, shouldn't you be writing about fire? And I decided, yes, I should be. And Burnt is what came out of that, and then the opinion articles followed.
The most recent one was published on CNN, and it was titled An American Firefighter's Honest Letter to Canada. What inspired you to write a letter of advice and foreboding of a warning to Canada?
Well, CNN contacted me and said, you know, we'd like you to do this compare and contrast. Like, what would America be doing differently? And that felt beyond my scope because I've never fought fire in Canada. I've never fought fire in the boreal forests. But what I could do, as I was thinking about it, is, you know, Canada doesn't have as much WUI as Wildland Urban Interface and Intermix as we do yet, but their population is growing. And so I thought, you know, what would I have done differently, you know, as a policymaker or as a person that was coming up through the ranks? Could I have done something, or could we as a people, or, you know, CAL FIRE as a department, have done things better? And that's when I kind of turned it into this epistolary mode, which was, Dear Canada, subtext also, Dear America, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and one of the biggest, you know, points that you make that stood out to me was about the building codes in rural communities and WUI areas, wildland urban interface areas. And you use this poignant example from your experience fighting the Morse fire, mm-hmm. and that was in the Monterey area back in 1987. Can you explain how that fire relates to the argument that building codes are falling short in areas that are high wildfire risk?
Sure. So in the United States, local government predominantly has authority to issue building permits and develop, you know, infrastructure and houses and commercial structures. So they're in effect, local government is in fact creating this wildland urban interface as we encroach out into the space that's available to build. But local government then cannot protect it. So that falls to state and federal government. So if you look to a country like Australia, they responded to their wildland fires that were like the Morse fire. And I'll go just a side note into the Morse fire. This was in Pebble Beach, California, in this just idyllic area in between a botanical garden and a famed golf course. And the local government had decided what was important to them in building this community that was there was aesthetics. They wanted it to match nature. The Coastal Commission weighed in, and then the local government building permit authority said, yeah, we want woodshake roofs, for example, because that'll fit beautifully in this wooded botanical area. And then, of course, when I arrived at the fire, the fire was just jumping from rooftop to rooftop to rooftop. They had done their job in making it match nature, and so now it was burning as if it were part of the wooded forest. So now go to Australia. The example is they, at the national level, which is their equivalent of federal law, decided that houses in these high-risk areas, and they call it bushfire zones, they were going to impose a national WUI code on the building of those homes. And so they would mandate certain performance values, like non-combustible roofs would be an example. So local government lost the authority to impose constructs that did not address the more global issue at this point of spreading wildfires.
When it comes to that wildfire that destroyed homes in 1987, that was over 30 years ago, when they rebuilt those homes, did they change building codes for the hard lessons that were learned from prioritizing aesthetics over reducing wildfire risk?
So yes and no. You can still find homes. Like I looked it up on realtor.com, and you can still find a woodshake home for sale in these multi-million dollar home areas. But since then, there have been improvements. Like if you're going to have woodshake shingles, they have to be pressure treated, which are more fire resistive, for example. But it's still not imposed at the level like, say, Australia would impose it.
Mm. And you bring up an important point, because when you go to these high wildfire risk areas, these WUI zones, there is this kind of complicated intersection of you have local jurisdictions like a county or a city, but it butts up to sometimes national forest or even state forests. Those are all different management and different agencies that are tasked. And there have been multiple times where I've talked to someone where a wildfire can start on national forest land, but it's butting up against like a county or a city. And so that brings up complications and to why I think you're saying a national or federal law or guideline would help streamline that.
It would help streamline how the houses are built. So the hardening homes and having them built to withstand wildfire. In terms of the response capability, we have, and I know you've seen with your background, you've seen our mutual aid at work. So because fire knows no boundaries, it's not going to stop it. Well, this is where the city ends, or this is where the federal forest ends. The fire's going to keep going. So we have an amazing kind of mutual aid response here in California and in other states in the West. Because we're tested every year. So it's closest resources respond no matter who they belong to. And there's contracts that that govern that, and people get together every year and update the contract as needed. So from a response perspective, it's pretty seamless. But from the prevention perspective and getting out ahead of it, it's not seamless at all.
And getting to the point of, you know, kind of shortcomings with prevention, you know, another key point you make, and you touched upon this when you first started your career, was prioritizing fire suppression as opposed to having this healthy balance with fire in the state. Have you seen the forests and just the vegetation change in the 30 plus years that you were a firefighter due to getting so good at fire suppression?
Yeah, I mean, I think I say in my article that we can't extinguish our way out of this problem. And that it means really prioritizing prevention from a budget perspective, too. And it never has the same sex appeal, right? You can't go in front of a council or, you know, a legislative body and go, hey, this is really urgent, important emergency stuff, because there's no flames and there's no smoke by the time you're making the argument. So it just doesn't ever have the same sex appeal that fire suppression does and funding suppression. I'm still a fan of quick suppression, especially during peak season months. But I think that we really need to shift some of the attention, some of the budget, and it is happening. I'm seeing it happen. But to answer like the part of your question is, have I seen a change in the fuel? Absolutely. It's what we have is really dry, receptive fuel right now. Even though we had a great wet winter, the fuel is still very eager, and you can see globally it's ready to burn.
Yeah. And those are two key points. You know, we're talking about building cones, building safer, a history of fire suppression that has consequences that are being felt today. And then a third point you make is what you call fire foolishness. What is fire foolishness?
It's what causes 80% of the fires, roughly. You know, it varies from year to year and it varies from region to region. But approximately 80% of our fires are caused by accident, meaning the people don't mean to start a fire, but their behavior starts a fire. And so in my mind, if it's accidental, it's preventable, right? Predictable is preventable. We can just get ahead of it. So imagine if we had 80% fewer fires just by not being stupid.
Mm-hmm. And we've had Smokey the Bear for quite a long time. Why do you think the number of human-caused fires stands at 80% and it hasn't dropped down in the decades that we've had public awareness campaigns?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I talk about this a little bit in my New York Times article. And Smokey Bear has, you know, become this kind of lovable, cuddly cartoon character. And if you look back at the old posters of his campaign, he's saying, please be careful. And clearly we haven't responded to that. So I think we need to up the ante. I think we need to stop saying please. I think we need something other than a lovable spokesbear to really kind of change our cultural approach to this. It has become so high stakes now with the body count, frankly, and then the number of lost homes and the destruction of timber, and just our forests in general are not healthy. So intentional fire is a different thing, and that can help regenerate and create healthy forests. But these unintentional fires that burn with high intensity that were started by accident, it's really inexcusable at this point.
So there should be more accountability.
It should be way more accountability. That's my take. And you can do it through, we're seeing some of it come in through, like with the Caldor fire that you mentioned. There's an accused father-son team who were out shooting in the woods where, you know, hot projectiles and a receptive fuel bed all in the in smoky air from the Dixie Fire. And it's alleged they are going for their preliminary hearing on August 11th. So we'll see what the court has to say about that. But so there's a criminal path for accountability if it becomes criminally negligent. And then there's a civil path, which Cal Fire has a very robust civil cost recovery program. But a lot of small departments and a lot of other states and a lot of other countries don't have those measures in place. We're just starting to use ours now.
When you think about a more effective campaign, you know, as opposed to, you know, like a cartoon, like a bear, are you thinking of like showing just the aftermath of what happens after the Caldor fire or the Camp Fire or these devastating, you know, at times deadly wildfires, and using that campaign as a more effective tool for public awareness as opposed to, you know, a happy bear asking you to, like, you know, just obey?
Right. No, I think that's a great idea, Vicky. I think that, a little bit of scared straight might be a better tact at this point. Like, you're not thinking about you bringing a heat source into these receptive areas at this point. It can cause serious damage and life loss. So yeah, why not show people that?
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're joined by Claire Frank. She is an author of the book Burnt, a memoir of firefighting, and spent more than 30 years as a firefighter and became Cal Fire's chief of fire protection. So talk to us about your memoir, 30 years of firefighting. How did you encapsulate that into a reasonable book? I'm looking at it. It's not like 1,000 pages.
Yeah, that was part of the trick. What I did was I just in terms of like process and structure, I kind of did an outline based on that follows the lifespan of a fire, you know, from its incipient stage all the way to when it's extinguished, which would equate to death. Clearly, I'm not there yet. But I witnessed that lifespan in a lot of fires and a lot of people in the fire service. So within that construct, I was able to kind of mine my memories to follow that arc, and that's what kept it kind of in a book form.
If we go back to the time when you were climbing the ranks in the 80s and 90s, what was it like for you as a woman being a firefighter?
I was very set on not being a female firefighter. I was set on, like, I'm just going to be a firefighter. And there's a word for it, and it's firefighter, and it's not fireman, and it's not firewoman. And I'm just going to concentrate on that. And if I concentrate on that, then everyone else will too. But which, for the most part, worked. There's always a few outliers, you know.
Yeah. And I guess, how did you navigate the outliers? You just kind of push through or ignore it and just kind of focus on the work?
I focused on the work, and then I have this personality trait, which I can't use on air. it's kind of a smart alecky way to call people out, but keep it light enough so they know I'm watching, they know I get it, they know I've set a boundary, but it isn't a downer for the whole room.
Yeah, it's not just being good at your job, but also knowing how, a part of being good at a job is knowing how to navigate personalities.
100%.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not just existing in a vacuum.
Right.
When you read a part of your memoir for Literary Deathmatch, which was a few months ago, there's a lot of humor in it as well. How did you find the space to inject humor in such a dire and devastating issue as firefighting?
This is another great question. I think, so part of it is just how I'm wired. And coming from a big family, you just learn to joke your way through life, right? So, but part of it is very specific to firefighting, and we resort to gallows humor as a coping mechanism. You know, it's how we compartmentalize and kind of do a quick band-aid, quick heel patch before we go on to the next traumatic scene that we see. So it's that combination of things, and it really is, in a way, it's just how we all have to get through life. You know, it's a little easier if you inject some humor.
Is there a broader message that you want to leave readers with when they close the book and they're done with it?
I think so. I think that it's follow your passion and kick the sides out of a box that somebody else put you in and that doesn't fit you.
Even though, you know, that time professionally has passed, it's still clearly a big piece of what drives you, and it drives you to write, you know, especially this summer. When you see wildfires happening in Canada, across Europe, of course, there's other countries as well, like a few years ago, I mean, Australia, you know, what comes to front of mind for you, given that you have had a front row seat to the evolution of wildfires and also the evolution of firefighting and readjusting over the decades? Because it's not just a California issue. It's not just a U.S. issue. It's a global issue, as we're learning and taking it in right now from international headlines.
Right. I think, you know, part of what I'm saying in these articles is the answer to that question, which is, can we please look back at mistakes we've made so that we don't repeat them? And again, it's not just California or the United States or one European country or Greece. It's the world right now. And so going back to Australia, I think part of what they did, and I haven't talked to anyone over there, so I'm just surmising, that they went, okay, local entity, you're making a decision that impacts, you know, the globe. At some point, every fire is impacting the globe, cumulatively, right? So I think looking at it from this very macro level is a healthy approach at this point. Mm.
Does that give you optimism that the future of firefighting and wildfires will, you know, reach a healthy balance in the coming years, not like 50 years from now, but maybe within the next decade?
I'm a pretty optimistic person, but I think a better word for how I'm feeling about it right now is I have hope.
Well, Claire, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Claire Frank is a writer and author of the book Burnt, a memoir of fighting fire. She has spent 30 years as a firefighter and became Cal Fire's chief of fire protection. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.